welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. On tonight's program, we've got a special treat for you in honor of the September celebration of King Records in Cincinnati. Back in 2008, three talented musicians who recorded at King Records came into the studio with me to share their memories. Orangy Ray Hubbard, Wilson Spivey Jr., and Herman Kress. Tonight, you'll hear their stories and how they came together and ended up playing at King Records on The Blues.
My name is Orangy, O-R-A-N-G-I-E, Ray Hubbard. My mother had a brother, and she was 8 months pregnant, and he got killed on a hunting expedition. And so 1 month later, I got the name. I was born in Knox County, 22333. The place that I was born is Turkey Creek. It wasn't, that's about, oh, I'd say 10 miles from Barberville. My great-grandmother was a Cherokee Indian. Some guy brought her there to that part of the Kentucky, got her pregnant and dropped her. And she had this boy, that was my grandfather on my mother's side. And he had bought a piece of land. He had a greyhound dog and a shotgun, and traded it to this 180 acres. About, I'd say, an acre of it was flat land. The rest of it was mountains. You didn't get your birth certificate from some place in Louisville, Kentucky, outside of Louisville. You just go to the Board of Education, and they would give you a blank slip. And I got three, and made me out three birth certificates, and went to Detroit, Michigan. I went to work for the automobile factory up there. And I worked my way from what to call American metal, which made seats for Fords, cushion room for Ford Motor Company. I left there. I worked there for quite a while. And I left there and went to Bud Wheel. Now, Bud Wheel was a company that made wheels for automobiles. You put your tires on. I left them and went to Hudson Motor Car Company. And across the street is where Chrysler was. So I went and got a job at Chrysler and was working at Hudson of a day and Chrysler of a night. So they went on about 6 months later, and they found out about it and told me that I would have to leave one of the jobs. It was against the company's rules. So I went to Chrysler. And when I went to Chrysler, through all this, I had gotten married to some little young woman. So she had gotten pregnant, and she wasn't going to have her baby in Detroit. So I had to leave Chrysler, and I went to work in Pineville Community Hospital as an orderly. And that's what I was doing at the time when the talent show come up. And so the show and everything was over with. Everything had died down. And for winning the talent scout show, I got a case of oil to do a grease job on my car. And Zeke Clemens, him and I got into it because he wanted me to record some of the old songs that he had written for Eddie Arnold. And I didn't want to do that. So he got mad at me. I really didn't care, but they were good songs. Anyway, the day that we had the final contest for the people, they decided that there was a tie, which I found out later that his aunt worked at the courthouse in Barberville, and she was one of the judges on the who wins this thing. So it was a tie between me and David Lundy. When you hear this song, I recorded this song in the Barberville radio studio on a two-track tape recorder. I was offered a lot of money at one time to show them how that I made this sound. And I don't care to tell people now how I done it. But what I did, I run a microphone out in the hall, and the band stayed inside of the studio because they had a little studio there to where every Sunday they had preachers that came in and they sang and they built a little studio to that. So you couldn't get a good sound with me singing there in the middle of the studio and all this music going on. So I took the microphone and ran it out in the hall and shut the door and syncopated the timing when we would start, and we got the sounds there for you to hear today.
Well, my baby got nothing but sweet love on my mind.
So as quick as my wife had the baby, I left there and went back to Michigan and got my job back with Chrysler. Then we came here in 1953 because my wife had a sister that lived here, and it was a beloved sister. Actually, I'd been fooling around. I couldn't play a guitar like nothing compared to what Junior Spivey plays or nobody else, just maybe chords and stuff like that. But I could sing a little bit. So I started out with Virgil Rice. He called me up. I was starting to sing around in a lot of clubs that already had their bands. So I thought, well, what I've got to do is to get familiar with the music here in Cincinnati. So I started going around to different clubs and started getting a little name from each of the people that was making the money. So Virgil hired me to play bass. I never played bass in my life. And I went to a guy named Glenn Hughes. He played a lot of sessions at King Records. He was one of the finest. What kind of guitar playing would you call?
He could play everything. Glenn? I mean, he could play like Les Paul or Dragons. Or
he could play anything.
Echoplex, I mean, genius.
He sold me a bass. I told him the story, you know. I says, the guy wants me to play bass. And I told him, I says, now, never played bass in my life. And he said, you won't learn any younger. So I went over there and he gave me a little old Gibson bass and an amplifier and told me, said, you take this. Glenn was a nice guy. He said, you take this. Now, as long as you want to turn this back in, you can turn it in as long as it's not scratched up or beat up or something. And I think I was only playing about $12 a month on it. So I took it in and I learned to play bass. And then along come Junior after that, and he was working with us. And what was the old man's name? Pappy Taylor.
Yeah, Grandpappy Taylor.
Yeah. Grandpappy Taylor now worked at Renfro Valley with the Coon Creek Girls. And he's got a brother that's still living playing fiddle, or they call it, violin. So I started wanting to work when I learned to play bass. Glenn had a lady working for him. and she would just book me. I said, I don't care what they pay, I'll play. So I was getting jobs every weekend. What I was doing was learning everybody's music, whether it was country, pop, rock, or what. So I figured that when I'm going to take my own band, and eventually I went to work with a couple of guys at a place called the Club Moonlight. So after that, well, I figured, well, I'm going to start my own band. And that's when I got Junior, Russ Mays, Herman Chris. We started playing, and then we fit together like a glove, and everybody in town, the place would just be packed wherever we went. And that's the way it started. What year we went over there?
I'd say it was right around 60, I'm thinking 66, 67.
We started out at Seven Oaks. Jimmy Nims was still playing at Club Moonlight.
Right.
So they got into it with the boss over there, and then we ended up there, Club Moonlight.
Yeah.
The guy that owned Club Moonlight, he wanted to sell it. He didn't own the property, but it was Stoney. He got mad at somebody. I don't know who it was. I was working for Stoney. Stoney got mad. Me and Stoney had a problem over him. When I'd want a drink, I drank Canadian Club and 7-Up. And he would take Guckenheimer, or what do you call it, and pour it in a
shot of red
the bottle.
Glass.
And I could tell the difference in the taste. And when somebody'd buy me a drink, well, he'd send that rot gut up there. And I sent it back, and we got into an argument over it. So I left there and went to
Cabana.
Steakhouse. It was a steakhouse. In other words, this was about as high a society that you could get. And then that's when I brought an organ in. And he was
sometimes
Truman Fields. I don't know if you ever heard of him or not.
He played behind Conway Twitty sometimes.
Yeah,
he played for Lonnie Mack.
One of the finest ones. And then I started changing drummers, he kept changing everything. Because we started doing, Junior was singing rock and roll.
Yeah.
Truman was doing Look at Me,
pop
stuff. And then I had a guy that could sing. If you turned your head, you thought it was Neil Diamond, Doug Beckelheimer. He played the bass. Now, I had a friend of mine whose name is Dennis Hensley. He owns a studio here in Northern Kentucky and still does. He was cutting records. It was what you call freelancing with other studios before he had his. He was out at Rusty York's cutting a session. But he called me up and told me, he said, I want you to come out here and bring your guitar. He said, because I might need you to do some rhythm work on this. This is what he was just telling me to get me out there. So I went out there, and when I got out there and when the session was over, he says, what I want you to do is walk out there and do 4 or 5 of those songs that you wrote. So I went out there and I did these songs. Well, 2 weeks later, they called me from King's. He had got me in through Louis Innes. And Louis Innes was working at King Records at the time. He was the A&R man out there. What Lou had done in his life, he was a rhythm guitar player for Chester Adkins. That was his career. Now, he was from Indiana. And he had wrote a couple of good songs, something about a choo-choo train or something. And now he was the guy that really set me down at King Records and told me everything that went on in Nashville, Tennessee. He worked for Adkins when Adkins would go and play music at these, like over here at Music Hall. Adkins would go there, like Chicago, Illinois. And Lou was a rhythm guitar player, and he played rhythm guitar for Adkins. So Louis called me in, and he called me into the studio and said, what do you want to do with these songs? If I'd had it to do over, I'd have said, Jerry, sell them. Somebody. I said, well, what would you want to do with them, Lou? And he says, well, we can get a band and come in here and do them. So well, I don't know how many songs we went through.
No,
remember that?
No, I don't know how many songs.
I took all the musicians that I knew that was capable of cutting anything that you wanted to do into the studio with me. So that's how I ended up in there. And we went in there and we'd go through this song and through that song. And how Junior ended up as a guitar, actually I took him in there because Dillard had a problem. he knew so much guitar, he couldn't take the same takeoff. Now, if you ever in a studio and you make a mislick on a takeoff or someplace you can't play the same as you did it before, they'll say, do that again. He would play it a different way. So we were right in the middle of a song, ka-thump it went. And so we had to stop. And the A&R man says, what happened? Dillard said, I missed my thumb. He's playing thumb-style guitar. Junior got the job then on every session that started because Lou wanted him there. Junior could play anything same way every day, tomorrow, and the next day too. Now, Sid didn't say too much to me. I was under the control of Louie Ennis. But now he would say things like, I remember what really pleased me one time when Big Cat, they were having a problem with it. I couldn't understand why, but Lou said, well, I'll tell you what's wrong with it. He said, it's rock and roll. It ain't country. So I spoke up and I says, I can fix it. How would you fix it? He said. I said, put a steel guitar on it. And he said, well, can you get one? I said, yes, sir. And I got Junior Boyer.
Yeah.
Come over and put the steel guitar on Big Cat. It was number 10 right here in Cincinnati. He got to be number 10. Sold a lot of records for King Records on that.
Baby of mine, he keeps coming back for more. See the big claw, the hair all over his neck. Well, odds are just about 90-1, she'll tear you up, Big Cat. See the big cat, he thinks he owns the town. He whipped all the men, now he thinks he can get any woman around. Girl. He walked into her trap. You whip me too bad for you. She'll tear you up, Big Cat.
Now, I got a disc that was recorded, come off of a tape that I recorded 20 years ago, probably longer than that. This is just everybody's songs. And this one here now is all rockabilly. This one here is. Then these over here, you see the color on that? You know what that is? That's a promotional copy. When they cut you at King Records, they cut promotional copies for you. Well, sometimes it was white. Now, here's the original color of King Records. It's blue. Now, here's a record that I recorded at King Records, but it's on Jewel Recording. That's the one that Rusty recorded. But now, this guy's name is Bill Helms. He went completely nuts over this song. But I recorded this song. Here's the story. You want to hear the story? I recorded this song and another song at King Records. Our Lasting Love is this one that he recorded. But it got on. Bill took it down to Nashville. Bill Helms had a big nightclub. I don't know if you remember him or not, Larry. Up here on 28. And he had a lot of money. And he built a Western bar up there. He loved this song and he wanted to record it, and I let him have it. how it got out of King Records was that I wasn't Lou, it was Sid, wanted me to come in and do a four-hour session for an audition to go on King Records. I did that audition. I cut two songs. The one of them that I'm talking about is Our Lasting Love. That's the one. And the other one, I think it's this In Search of You here. I think now, I'm not sure. Either that or On the Lucky One. It's either one or the other. Maybe Look What I Found it could have been. Anyway, the story about it, I was new in Cincinnati, but I was working down at General Motors. Dennis took me to see Lou, that Lou took me over and started working with me. And first one we did on King Records, but now this was done first. But it happened, there was a guy working in Barberville, Kentucky, and his name is Walter Powell. We had a college in Barberville. It's called Union College. And he went to Union College, and he took electronics and became a wanted to buy a radio studio. This is going back to Payola. Should I say this? I was there going out. Yeah, Walter Powell, he called me up. Now, his mother and my mother were kids that ran together and went to school together. And we families were real tight. And he became a disc jockey. And he was working on Barberville Radio down there. But now he told me that they was either 15 or 25 disc jockeys in the Disc Jockey Association. This is where I got the payola deal at. You know, I figured it out myself later on. But now L.A. was wherever they do the movies at, they were going to do a song about DJs. And he said, if you can get me a song, a demo, or anything, he says, I can have 3 minutes play in a movie that they're going to call Mr. DJ. So I would go by King's every day to see if Sid had listened to my tape. Nope, he ain't listened to it yet. Well, this went on, and I was really under pressure because I wanted to send that to get this spot in this movie.
It just moved in. It just moved in. It just moved in. It just moved in. Well, it just moved in and I got me a brand new friend. Well, down the street just about the square, the cats and me jump and they don't care. They clap their hands and they move their feet. All little baby dogs look so sweet.
So I came by there and there wasn't nobody there one day, and I picked the tape up and brought it out of there and took it to a guy when I came. You ever hear of Carl Burkhart? He owned Wright Records on the west side. And I didn't know anything about Cincinnati that much. So I took it down there to him to get a demo. I couldn't take the tape back to King. Say, here, I stole the tape. I won't get me a demo. But I took it over there. And at that time, Carl Burkhart had recorded Carl Dopkins Jr. You remember the name? He's here in Cincinnati. I think he was on Roulette. I think they sold him. Carl, at that time, when I walked in the studio to get a demo to send to Walter so he could do that thing for me, he was upset because he had put this guy out, and I think it cost like $1,000 for him to do what he had done. And he sold his contract to this company, and this company took it and made $1 million of it. Well, he was disgusted, and he was listening to my songs on that tape, and he said, "Where'd you cut this at?" And I said, "I cut it at King Records." He said, "How come you didn't come over here and cut it here?" Now, he was an idiot. I says, "Well, I didn't even know you existed." And when I said that, he jerked my tape off. He took my tape off from the wall, and because he had one of those you wind up on the wall. So I began to apologize. I said, "I'm sorry, sir. I need this demo bad. I think he's only going to charge me $3 for it or something." So finally I got him calmed down, and he did me a demo on it, but I didn't get it there in time. So that was something that I missed. But it was made at King Records. When I went into King Records, Lou asked me, he said, "You know any good country pickers?" I was playing with two different guitar players. A guy by the name of Dillard Anderson played guitar, and the other guy, his name, we called him Junior, but his name was Wilson Spivey Jr. We played together for, well, long before you was born, I guess.
My name is Wilson Spivey Jr., and I was born on 1513 Race Street on the third floor, Cincinnati, Ohio, 1948. More or less raised up in bluegrass music, a lot of bluegrass. My dad started learning to play banjo when he was around 26 years old. He played guitar before that, though. And then after that, just grew up around that, and then my dad started playing at this place called the Chicken Roost. I mean, he played several places before that, but he played there 15 years with a guy named Virgil Rice. One of my first good-paying jobs was with Virgil Rice. So after my dad played there 15 years, Virgil changed formats and went from the bluegrass to the traditional country. And then that's when I came in and started playing guitar. My dad went on with his bluegrass to other places. Well, I met Orangey before that at Joe's Lake, I believe it was. I brought up a dime and requested a song. I was just a little kid. My dad was playing over there, and Orangey was there. And I met Orangey, and later on I met Orangey again at the Chicken Roost before I played there. And that's right after Virgil had switched over to the traditional country. And he was playing, I think Dillard Anderson was playing guitar, and I can't remember if Ernie Baker was playing steel that night or not, but he was there all the time. And then Russ Mays on drums, and Orangey was on bass, and I had the time of my life. And then later on, it's all history there, but anyway, I started playing with Orangey, and we played together one stint. We played 7 years straight, nonstop. And then off and on, I'd play different bands, this and that, and then we got back together and played all together about 16, 17 years, I'd say. So we went on playing. We had a real good following in this one club and had some problems with it. And Orangey said, "Don't worry about it, boys. Said, I'm going to get you working tonight." And he went up the street to this place there. That's when we was at the Roundup. Remember that, Orangey? That Gene Kenny, whatever his name was. He gave us a bum steer. So he went up the road there and got us a job. And it was a New Year's Eve job. That's how short it was, but he talked us right into that job right like that. He always kept us working, and we was really proud of the fact we worked up, like, say, 40 or 50 songs nonstop. We have an introduction between each song to go to the next song. So we had a really, I was really proud of it, really tough band, I thought. After everything kind of faded around here for a while, then I got on the road with Kenny Price and went to Nashville and played with him for a long time, and for about a year. After that, come back, try to make a living again, you know, and it was very hard to make a living playing music around here. And so then I ended up on the road again for an old comedy group called Lonzo and Oscar. Stayed on the road with them about a year, year and a half, and then got to play the Grand Ole Opry down there several times, the newer Opry, and never got to play the old one, though. I always wanted to play the old one. But I never got to play the old one, got to play the new one, though. But I got to play it several times and got to play the Ernest Tubb Record Shop one night. And that was a big deal for me. And I got paid a $20 check, and I was needing money, and I sold it for $25. But that's the way it was. And I played on and on and on until my health got so bad I couldn't play that much. And so that's where it's about laid at. You know, now I play once in a great while and kind of more or less retired. So that's about it for me right there, you know.
You said I could be something if I tried. Now you say I'm just a worthless piece of hide. I had a home and love, but suddenly it stopped. Now I'm down on the bottom, all the way from the top. Now there goes the girl that I love so. But I'm just a guy she used to know. Well, I was number one, but suddenly I dropped. Now I'm down on the bottom, all the way from the fun. Yes, heaven knows I've tried, but some things you can't stop. Now I'm down on the bottom, all the way from the top.
Well, I don't know what year it was. I'm thinking around 66, 67, 68, somewhere around there. And Dillard was playing on the one side of the record, it was Peepin' Tom. And then he played on the other side, which was Down on the Bottom. And what happened was Dillard completed the Down on the Bottom, but he never got, well, he did one part on the Peepin' Tom, and then Orangey decided to bring me in to play a little bit in the background there. So that's how I got started with King Records.
Peepin' Tom, do you remember back years ago when there was this thing about Peepin' Toms? They was police was arresting them. They were running around their houses, peeping through people's windows, and then they called them Peeping Toms. That's how come I wrote the song. So it's about a peeping Tom, but it's me in the song. I'm the peeping Tom. In other words, the words in there, it says that I found his marks on the door and peeking through the keyhole, and the night I cried till dawn.
Who said I fell in love with a pretty little girl and she really made a fool of me? What's that stuff about I wouldn't give up and she had me down on my knee? I'm gonna find him, yes siree, give him a piece of my mind. Well, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? He must be a peeping Tom. Well, found his tracks on the living room rug and I traced it through the hall. That's where he stopped at my bedroom door. His marks were all over the wall. He must have been a-peeking through my keyhole the night I cried till dawn. Well, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? He must be a peeping Tom. That you've heard and only half of what you see. There's the dirty bird's been spreading the word and it's got me figured down to a T. Well, who's been a-peeking through my private life for snooping around my home? Well, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? It must be a peeping Tom. Yeah, found his tracks on my living room rug and I traced it through the hall. That's where he stopped at my bedroom door. His marks are all over the wall. He must have been a-peeking through my keyhole the night I cried.
till dawn. Well, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? It must be a peeping Tom. Yeah, found his tracks on the living room rug and I traced it through the hall. That's where it stopped at my bedroom door. His marks were all over the wall. Well, he must have been a peeking through my keyhole the night I cried till dawn. Well, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? It must be a peeping Tom. Yeah, what kind of cat would do a thing like that? It must be a peeping Tom.
I don't remember much of an air conditioning in there. It's kind of damp, cool, cause, you know, the moisture. But now when it would rain, sometimes they put buckets out and you could hear the rain hitting in the buckets while they was recording. Like four or five buckets sitting around one day. Because, you know, it needed repair, of course. But it was exciting to me, though, and to see all these things I hadn't seen before. Like they had a big set of kettle drums and stuff over there in the corner. They had about any kind of sound you wanted there. They had that big Steinway piano and all the big stuff for a kid like me. I never seen a Steinway in person, so I was seeing it at King Records. It was good days. That's the only way I can say. It was fun, but it was hard because Orange, he'd get an idea and he'd be like a pit bull. He wouldn't let go until we got it the way he wanted. But he was a hard worker. He worked my fingers to the bone. But he was a good man to work for. And then after that, we had the Big Cat, and then I played all the leads on that. And then I can't remember who played Steel. I know it was Ray Wilson played Steel, but we also had Junior Boyer. He played Steel, and then we had Russ Mays. And then, well, in fact, on one song, they had Russ Mays, and they wasn't satisfied with that, and they brought in Jackie Gibbs to do an overdub with brushes along with his track to fill it in. So, and then I think Herman was playing bass, and we were still a band then. And then from that point, I remember I was asking Orangey, I don't know, but there was a woman there that did a song, and I thought she had done one of Orangey's songs named Leona Williams. And I remember being there for the recording session. Then so through that connection, I end up Louie Ennis. He's the one who helped us get in there and all that stuff. And then he told me one time, he called up and said he needed me for a session. So I got over there, and it was for Hank Ballard. And we did a whole album with Hank Ballard. And what it was, I've made a note of that. What they was doing, they was taking at the time, it was a guy named Syl Johnson, supposedly. And he had on the whole album cut, but he had dropped them and went to another label. So they was taking the same songs and playing them back, but here was Hank Ballard and me and the whole band, his whole band, was playing along. And so actually they was taking the same songs, but they was changing them around to a different arrangement with the same chord range and everything. It came out that way. Not the first time I met him, but the first time I met Sid Nathan was with Orangey in his office that time. I was scared to death. But I was out there that night with Hank Ballard, and then I was only about 18, maybe 19 at the most. Sid Nathan come out there, and he's grumbling around about something. Then he punched the button. He asked Hank Ballard, said, "Hey," he said, "What?" He said, "Where'd you get the man of color at?" He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The white boy." And I guess he had forgot who I was because, you know, he couldn't see anyway. But I took it as a compliment, twisted compliment. But other than that, I never got to really talk to him a whole lot. Orangey did a lot of talking with him. They haggled around and argue around about this, about that. And, well, he was wanting Orangey to sign a contract to go national, because we did real good regional. So he wanted him to go national, and then Orangey stepped up. Well, I'll think about it. And then history, he passed away. So that's where it left us hanging at. Another couple things, I was always a big fan of country music, but around 63, I got hooked on Lonnie Mack. Oh, I went nuts over that. So I incorporated him in a lot of my style that I play. And even when I play today, you can still hear that influence there. So. And I was fortunate enough to get to play a couple shows with him. So that was my lifelong dream, to play like that, to be like that, or whatever. But then I always went back to the country music because that's where the money was to make the living. In fact, I had one chance, well, that's right before Sid Nathan died too, but this guy named Bud Hobgood, he worked for James Brown Productions. And he had offered me and my brother, Ed, he was a great keyboard player and bass player, played bass 9 years before he went to keyboard, and our drummer, Harvey, and offered to make me a couple instrumentals. And I was jumping, going crazy for that on King Records. But what happened was Bud went into the hospital, and he got sick with an abscess tooth or something, and they gave him something. He had a reaction, and he passed away. So that was up in smoke. Always reaching for that little nuance to be there on King, but fortunately, I was with Orangey. I was on King Records with Orangey, so I could say I have played King Records. and with Hank Ballard. So I don't know whatever became that record. I wish I could find it. Whatever happened about that Hank Ballard record, if it ever came out. But we did a whole album. Mostly it was like a lot of it was chink rhythm because they had the horns. A couple of leads, I think, from what I remember, but I don't know. Only the connection I have is the way the guys was talking. There was a guy named Sylvester, but they called him Sil. Sil Johnson was the songs. I don't know if he wrote the songs or I knew he had recorded them, but some way about the label, and he split and went somewhere else, and they're going to bring it back. And it's supposed to be some kind of like a comeback album for Hank Ballard. Some of them guys, the horn players, had their parts. Some of them, they could read the music that was playing along. But what it was, we basically, each song, we just sat there with our earphones on and listened to it a couple times, and then we'd play along with it. But what we was trying to do was keep with the drums they had put on there as we was going, because it would be just a little slightly different beat, but it'd be in the same rhythms area. So we was double tracking, more or less. They had the track running, and we'd play along with it. Then when they got it where they liked it, then they would cut the other track out. And then, of course, Hank would go back and redo his thing, they said later. Of course, a couple of times he wanted to get in. He's right on the money because he's singing the same words and everything. Only way I could explain it is I guess it was double tracking some way. But the way we did it, we just sat there and listened to it till we got familiar with it. Basically, like no more than 3-4 chord songs, rhythm and blues, and a lot of them 3-chord songs and stuff like that. So it was very easy to do as far as the structures, because basically a lot of that falls in the same category, but just a different beat. And a couple of songs would be really difficult because the drummer would have to keep his beat by listening to the other guy's beat. And so he was what holding it together, him and the bass man and the piano. So that's what saved us all, as far as, you know. But whatever came of it, I don't know. I would love to hear it. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
My name is Herman Kress. I was born January the 4th, 1935, in around Beattyville, in between Beattyville and Jackson, Kentucky. So I went to high school in Jackson, Breathitt County High School. And there met Rusty York. Well, I was singing in the glee club there, and the teacher wanted us to go to a radio station called WMTC in Van Cleve, Kentucky, and do a song on radio. So Rusty and I went over there, and he backed me up on guitar, and I sang my first song on WMTC in Van Cleve. I then came to Cincinnati. I met a fellow named Don Boone, Zeke Browning. One day, I was concentrating more on rhythm guitar and singing than I was playing bass, and so their bass player didn't show up one day, so they wanted me to play bass with them, and that was one of the things that wasn't even on my mind at the time. So I said, okay, I'll try. And they showed me my first couple chords. And basically, I took it from there. And then we played some in clubs and places and benefits and outings and stuff. And then to further my procedure on the bass, upright bass, Carl Ingram came along, and he helped me out quite a bit. Carl does live over here in Northern Kentucky. After that, I become pretty much accomplished on the upright bass. We did shows and clubs and everything then. And then my buddy Glenn Scott was playing on WCPL-TV on a show called Corners Jamboree with Bob Sreese and Big Jim Stacy. And Glenn wanted me to come up there to Channel 9 and play bass with him. So then Nelson Young helped me get me on the air with a show with the Corners of Jamboree, along with the Comar Brothers, Glenn Scott, Freddie Lane, and, of course, Bob Sreeves. And, of course, I got Don Boone on later on there also, too. So that was mainly the crew on WCPO. Sometimes we had Bob Braun, who ran the camera for us. Of course, he was there with he had a pantomime hip parade with Dottie Mack and Bob Sree, and that was on network at night there. So I was on there, WCPO, for approximately 2.5 years. So then I kindly bowed out because I was working at General Motors, and I couldn't get on night shift to be on day shift when he was on every day at 10:30. That's about it for that. I met Orangy in around 1955, and how we became acquainted. He saw me on Channel 9, and he thought that I did a good job on upright bass. And he came to see me, and him and I worked at the same place. And he wanted me to go to Barberville, Kentucky. He had won a contest down there with Zeke Clemens had got together and the radio station in Barberville. And it was like a Elvis-type contest for a guy that sang kind of like Elvis or done his songs or whatever. Orange had done a song called Sweet Love on Dixie label. And we recorded it in a radio station there at Barberville. Anyway, we had Riley Tipton on lead guitar. The drummer, I can't think of his name right now, but I played bass on it. And it turned out to be a pretty good rockabilly song at the time. So after that, we went to Lucky Records and recorded some songs on Lucky Records. So then Homestead Records also, Jewel Records, and then, of course, King Record. And we did, not sure how many we did on King, but we got two or three on King Record. After that, well, I got to play with Kenny Price, Jay Neese and Freddie Langton and Kenny Price and the Hometowners on record at King Record. Also Bobby Grove. In the earlier days, I got to sit in the studio with Sid Nathan, and I got to watch Moon Mulligan record Jambalaya at that time. So I thought, I like Sid. He was a real shifty person, but I really liked Sid. We got along fine. Then after that, when Ray Pennington came into King, and Sid pretty well turned him loose doing just about anything, all kinds of things in there. He produced a record, one in particular, with Hawkshaw Hawkins called Lonesome 77203. He played drums on it and produced it too. So he had a song on the backside of the record that he had written that Hawkshaw put on the B-side of the record. Some of the records back then, the engineer, Chuck Seitz, I cut under him. And then, of course, he went to RCA and then he came back to Queen City Albums. And I cut quite a bit under him. Jim Deeks also. And King Record, well, we had a sound in there that I thought it was a real wonderful sound. And I played upright bass in there, and I had some kind of a big sound in there with that upright bass, and it really sounded great. Some of the guys that I recorded with there were Diller Anderson, of course, playing on Archie Hubbard's records. Also, I think Junior Spivey plays on some records there, and the steel player, well, his name was Wilson. Can't hardly think of his last name right now. Oh, we would park out in the back and go in the side door down first floor in the studio. How we get in there. The studio was pretty level, I think, as far as I can remember, with the bottom floor of the ground, the parking lot and area down there. The bass that I started off with, I bought used from Glenn Hughes, and then I traded it in later on and got a new bass. The bass is called K Swingmaster, which I still have at home. Then later on, it came to the point where that in order to be more productive and faster when Elvis come out with, especially, well, even in the early days, Bill Haley was going rock and roll, you know, and Elvis came in. Then drums was not in country music at the time. I had to play a beat on that bass and a tone too, as much as I possibly could. It was pretty rough work back then. But I got honed in pretty good on it because I got to cut a lot of sessions in Cincinnati and bluegrass and country and rockabilly. Anyway, I went to, after the upright bass, I went to electric bass. I went to Dave and Hanser, bought me an amplifier, bassman, Fender bassman, and a Precision Fender bass guitar. And it was quite a change switching over from upright bass to electric, but I did it. And then that was about the time that I started with Orangey Hubbard. Well, just a little bit later, and I was doing electric bass on most of the songs he'd done and at King Record. And then, of course, the other labels. We cut one record particular at Herzog Studios down on 3rd Street, in which I understand that, from the best of my knowledge, that Hank Williams cut I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry in the studio. I think these recording studios that were set up back then, they was kind of small town operators, and they didn't have a big sound as King. King had a renowned sound, a national sound. They were big time all the way. King did everything. King had their own promoters, publishing. They had their own pressing plant. They had their own, well, of course, their own engineers and their own studios, see. So they did it all. I mean, back when some of the guys was playing on WLW, like Merle Travis and Hank Penny, Joe Mavis, and Grandpa Jones, Sid had a little music shop around the corner from WLW, Crosley Square, it was called then. He was wanting to start a recording studio, and he asked some of the guys, he said, would you like to record? And of course, they was anxious, you know, to get some stuff on records. And so they said, okay. And so he said, I have a temporary studio in Middletown up over the old Welser Music Store. And he said, I think it was Welser Music Store. And he said, if you guys want to go up there and do some recording, when he got it ready, well, they went up there and they went in and done some recording under the Browns Ferry 4, which consisted of Grandpa Jones and Merle Travis and Joe Mavis and the Delmo brothers. Of course, then that's before Grandpa was really started his own career as Grandpa Jones. It was pretty exciting back then because, well, I was really young and it was really new to me, the recording industry was. But I really liked it. I sat in the control room beside Sid Nathan while he was recording. And Moon Mulligan also played his keyboard and sang on the Grand Ole Opry. He had a song out, in particular, I remember right now, when it was called I'll Sail My Ship Alone. Rusty and I, when he would go out of town, sometimes if I wasn't busy, I'd take his place. Because he went on Dick Clark Bandstand, and he also had a record out in 1959 that made a pretty good hit called Sugar Ree. I recorded in Rusty's studio several times. Matter of fact, I've got my picture with Larry Sparks in there when we were recording with the Dr. Ralph Stanley. We recorded a record with him, Larry Sparks and Dennis Hensley and myself. I got to play with him and Carter at the Wagon Wheel in Hamilton. Matter of fact, they were our guests there, Archie Hubbard and the band, the Cherokee band. They didn't have no bass player that night. Moon Mullins and was playing fiddle with them, and they needed a bass player. So we'd play 30 minutes on, 30 minutes off. And so I played the whole hour because we had to play 30 minutes. Cherokees did, and Ralph Stanley and Carter. The Cherokee band, well, Junior Spivey and I started a little band with Russ Mays, and we played a place called Club Moonlight and another little place. Then about that time, we were recording with Orangey, and so he wanted to come in with a band. And so Orangey came in with a band, and he named the band the Cherokees. So that's how they got their name. Junior Spivey, Russ Mays, and myself and Orangey. And then later on, Truman Fields came in on the keyboard. And Truman was one of the finest keyboard men I've ever played with in Cincinnati. He played with Conway Twitty, Hard Times. He recorded the song called Memphis, Tennessee that Lonnie Mack recorded back then. Yes, I know Lonnie used to come and play on radio with me and Don Boone and Teddy Brown and all of us over at Sims in the Wenda on Vine Street. We played on radio every day over there. And so him and Ralph Trotta would come up and sit in and sing a song or two with us on radio. Ralph Trotta was a blind guy that he helped Lonnie a lot on his lead guitar playing. This was, I guess, around 1960 or somewhere along there.
She's my strawberry rose. She's the love of my life, the mother of my children, don't you know? She's my strawberry rose. got tired of living in this small country town and longed to see the bright lights far away. She lived bright and early on a big old greyhound, and it hurt me so tears filled my eyes when that big dog rolled away. She's my strawberry rose. She's the love of my life, the mother of my children, don't you know? She's my strawberry rose. I didn't blame her for leaving. She had to follow her big dream, and it wasn't right for me to hold her down. But the bright lights of the city ain't always what they seem, and they were cruel to a country girl who didn't know her way around. She's my strawberry rose. She's the love of my life, the mother of my children, don't you know? She's my strawberry.
I just got word this morning that my darling Rose had died. Now the pain I bear, only heaven knows. It's when they found her body lying, she had a ticket in her hand to come back to me, but now I'll never see sweet strawberry rose.
She's my strawberry rose. She's the love of my life, the mother of my children, don't you know? She's my strawberry rose. She's my
Herman Kress, who played bass with Orangy Ray Hubbard on a number of King Records recordings. You also heard from guitarist Wilson Spivey Jr. And at the beginning of this special, from Orangy Ray Hubbard, all of whom recorded at King Records. Technical assistance tonight from Brian Powers. I'm producer and host Lee Hay, and you're listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.